Case number 23-1124. John Doe, claimant number one, petitioner versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Cohn for the petitioner, Ms. Parisi for the respondent.
Morning, Mr. Cohn.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Steve Cohn, attorney for John Doe, and with me is Kayla Swahovic, my co-counsel. The central issue before this court is whether Doe's voluntary disclosures to two major well-respected newspapers, which triggered a very successful SEC enforcement action, was voluntary under Dodd-Frank. The secondary issue is whether the timing of a form known as TCR was submitted in a timely manner. As I believe explained in the briefs, the TCR issue most likely would be subsumed in the voluntary issue. In its final order, the SEC conceded critical facts, which under Dodd-Frank, Doe was a fully qualified whistleblower within 72 hours. His original information had gone to the SEC through the media. It triggered an investigation. And as we know, there was a successful enforcement action.
Is this argument preserved? It doesn't seem that you made this argument before the SEC in the current form that you're making it before us.
Your Honor, we did, and we did it with, I believe, laser precision. What we did before the commission is we identified the very specific regulation that was used to deny Doe's arguments. We went into that regulation's regulatory history and evaluated it and found that the commission itself understood that that regulation could have unintended consequences denying valid whistleblowers.
I understand that that's the argument, and maybe this is the best spin you can put on it, but the idea is, don't you have to put before the commission the same argument you're putting before us so that they have an opportunity to address it? And although you use the word plain meaning, you used it in support of a different argument. It's about this disclosure to media.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because after we explain the regulatory history, this is the exact quote. If this oversight, in other words, if not including the media in the definition, was intentional, it would constitute a highly troubling violation of the DFA's plain language. So I believe we made a plain language argument directly related to the regulation at issue.
It's related, but it's not the argument that you're making before us, because the argument you're making before us doesn't depend on the media process. Your argument for us is you're looking at traditional tools of statutory construction and saying the plain meaning of voluntary doesn't mean what the commission means. And that's a different argument, isn't it?
It's a different spin on the same argument.
So why is that okay?
Putting
a different spin, if you didn't put it before the SEC and give them an opportunity to address it, how is that preserved?
First, because it's really the intervening decision in Loper. This court stayed this case pending Loper. Loper shifted the entire analysis in this proceeding from a Chevron analysis to a Loper analysis.
How does Loper affect the arguments you make before the SEC? That's a statutory construction case. It's not about an issue preservation and what kind of arguments can you make before the SEC?
Yeah, because before the SEC, Chevron was the law. This court would give deference to those regulations.
So you're saying it would be futile for you to raise that before the SEC?
Absolutely, because we'd already raised this very issue in another case, and the commission dug in and said they stood strongly behind their definition of voluntary in a very similar circumstance. So we already knew, in fact, I argued that case, we already knew that the commission was not going to change its regulation. And we had to deal with Chevron, but we raised plain meaning from the beginning to the end of that argument, because ultimately we also raised the term voluntary, I think 70 times. It was clear that the entire issue of the case was an interpretation of voluntary. Now, in regard to the media, there's two ways to look at their regulation.
Well, before you get into that, your definition of voluntary is that as long as you're cooperative, you're being voluntary. You don't have to initiate the contact with the SEC. Am I correct?
No. Our definition of voluntary goes to the root cause. Who initiated the investigation? What original information initiated the investigation? And at that point, you can look at the definition of original information, which we hammered away at, and look at who's permitted under the law to do that. And if you went to the news media and the commission learned it from the news media, you are covered. And it would only make common sense
is
that
it's a different argument, though. Correct me if I'm wrong, because now I'm getting a little bit confused, because I thought you had two alternative arguments. One argument was about the plain meaning of the word voluntary. And number two was the way in which the commission has treated the media compared to other institutions or entities that you could make a disclosure to first. Are those two different arguments, or is that one argument?
They're interrelated, but they're different.
Okay, I'm trying to talk about number one, which is just the meaning of the word voluntary, which is a pure statutory construction. Let's look at the words of the statute. What do they mean? Kind of argument. And it seems to me that your definition of voluntary would make a lot more people eligible whistleblowers. And we're talking about very large awards here, like 10 to 30% of large sums of money. And you're saying that if the SEC already knows about your whistleblower, and that, but they're voluntary, they get that kind of money. The only thing that whistleblower is saving them is the trouble of getting a subpoena. And it doesn't seem to me that your statutory interpretation of the word voluntary could possibly be what Congress intended.
So that is why we argued that if you look at Congress's selection of specific third-party entities for which a whistleblower could transmit, they could go to these third parties, like the Justice Department, like Congress, and give them information. If that information was then transmitted to the SEC, it becomes award eligible. So
you shifted to the second argument? Because I'm trying to
Two are completely interrelated, because if you have to be voluntary to the third party. So the concept of voluntary just carries over. If Congress subpoenaed you, it doesn't count. If DOJ subpoenaed you, it doesn't count. Only if you were voluntary to DOJ, voluntary to Congress, voluntary to the news media, then it shifts. Then if you look at any common sense, plain meaning of the term voluntary, it holds. That's the whole argument. That's why they're interrelated.
Why would Congress adopt your approach, given that the entities it did identify are entities that traditionally do investigation, as opposed to just spilling something out to the media, which has no regulatory or statutory constraints? And I agree with Judge Penn. I'd like to stick to each argument, but to the extent you're arguing they're interrelated, isn't your definition of voluntary then incorporating the word original? And you're saying that that is contrary to Congress's intent.
Going to the first one, Congress knew that whistleblowers go to the news media. So in the False Claims Act, they would credit whistleblowers with original information, award eligible, if the government learned it from the news media. Then you go to the IRS law, which this one was directly predicated on, and which we cite in our appeal.
Predicated is not the same as identical.
Well, pretty much identical, because in the IRS law, They have an entire mechanism exactly like this, in which they identify the type of original information that the IRS can learn, and they make it equal if the whistleblower went to DOJ, IRS, or the news media. And then the next section says, if the IRS learns it from the news media, you can get your 10 to 30%.
They don't. I thought Congress's whole theory was we want to provide an incentive for people who otherwise would not come forward. And if people are already talking to the media and to these entities named by Congress, why would Congress think there was a need for this type of, as Judge Pan points out, a substantial monetary?
And that would be a question really for Congress, because Congress knew. Yeah, but Congress knew that whistleblowers go to the media. Congress knew.
Doesn't that cut against you? If Congress knew that and they chose not to include the media in the statute or in the regulation.
No, they did in the statute. The statute specifically says
not related to voluntariness, related to original. They didn't provide for this.
If you can get an award by giving original information to the news media, then you have to look at the term voluntary as to where and how the information was originally given.
Correct, but those are two different terms in the statute, and they've defined original in one way, and you're saying that they have to define voluntary in this other way, and I don't see why they have to do that.
It's called harmonizing a statute, reading a statute in context.
Yes, but to rule in your favor, we have to rule that they had to do it that way. There's no other way to do it.
No, you have to give the best meaning to the term voluntary. In the context of a statute in which Congress specifically says you can give original information qualifying for an award to the SEC through the news media, then you have to go and read the term voluntary in context. If you cut voluntary off in the way they're doing, it eliminates that right. And furthermore, that right is nothing. It's so codified within the very essence of whistleblowing.
Wait, it doesn't eliminate the right to go to the media. You can go simultaneously to the media and the commission. You can go to the media and very quickly to the commission. I mean, the notion that it somehow penalizes the ability to go public just seems unpersuasive to me, but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, Congress knew organically how whistleblowers blow the whistle, because there was an entire history. The amicus brief from the publications lay out some of the major cases. The SEC's own policy statement, and this is critical because that policy statement was 2006, comes straight out and validates whistleblower the actions of the news media in triggering investigations. Their own enforcement manual says the SEC officials should read the newspapers. And just like in this case,
if something is original, it must be voluntary.
If something is original,
it must be voluntary.
No, you then look at the origin of the original information. So in their regulations,
what I'm trying to get at, counsel, is that you're trying to incorporate the definition of original into the interpretation of voluntary. And I'm trying to understand, are you trying to say that if something is original, because it can be original if it originates from the media, that it must be voluntary?
No, absolutely not. So when the SEC realized in the rulemaking that their definition could have an inadvertent bad consequence, denying people who go to third parties of their status as a qualified whistleblower, they did the rule. And the rule says if you're voluntary to the third party, your original information is voluntary. If you're involuntary to the third party, your original information is involuntary. And that is in two specific rules of the SEC, their definition of voluntary and their definition of original information. In their own definition of original information, they unite the two. But the two must be read in context. You have to look at this statute in the context, not only of the statutory language, but of the history behind it, the laws they used, the fact that Congress was permitting media disclosures in the two other award laws.
But so, Mr. Cohen, let's say there's a voluntary disclosure to a regional, a very small regional newspaper, and the SEC's investigators do read the news, but it takes them 6 months until they actually read this small regional newspaper. And in the meantime, the whistleblower has not come forward. It seems to me that that's the kind of case that the whistleblower awards are trying to incentivize to come more quickly. Whereas if anything that's voluntary to the third party is deemed to be voluntarily provided to the SEC, then there's no incentive to shorten that 6 month delay and to ease the burden of the commission's investigators who are having to comb, you know, these off the beaten track news media sources.
Yes, so it's quite the way the law works is original information is essentially first to file. The first group that goes in. I could go to the newspapers and have a million articles published, but unless the investigators themselves rely on that, it's not original information because they're not using it,
right,
and another whistleblower can cut them off.
Right.
That's on point A. Now let's go look at the exceptions that the commission carved out. If I go to an SRO, a corporate-run arbitration group, and I make a voluntary disclosure of original information, and that SRO spends 5 years, until they forward my disclosure to a private entity, to the commission, the commission will credit it as original, and the commission will credit it as original information and voluntary.
I'm not sure that you've answered my question, maybe indirectly.
Okay.
What you're saying is that same kind of delay might happen with the third parties that communications to whom are considered voluntary under the rule. And so my, you know, hypothetical about delay in the investigators finding the news media could equally apply to the PCAOB. Is
correct.
I take to be your answer. But
correct.
I think the judgment reflected in the rule is these are not just third parties, they're authorities that have parallel enforcement responsibilities. And so maybe part of the judgment, I would understand part of the judgment that the commission is making in including the the PCAOB and not including the media is if the PCAOB is acting slowly, that's because it's not important or because they've got it covered. And the enforcement community they're thinking of is sort of more, has more aligned interests and is more in communication with one another than they are with the entire press. And that just seems to me to make sense. And in some way, I mean, I think there's an unfairness to people like your client and kind of an irony in saying, well, people need the awards as incentive to come forward. And therefore, someone who was so voluntary that he didn't need an award, he's actually bona fide voluntary. He did this with no award in view, then he doesn't get it. So there, I get it that that seems unfair. But in reading the statute and in trying to understand whether the commission's rule interpreting it is valid, I think they have a very reasonable and supportable judgment. And even under just Skidmore or no deference at all, it seems like that's a judgment that we're not necessarily in a position to disturb.
I would respectfully disagree. And I think it comes right down to Skidmore. Skidmore required the SEC during the rulemaking to use its experience and informed judgment in crafting a regulation. If they didn't, they get no consideration. At the time in 2010.
If it's longstanding and it's a reasonable interpretation, it falls under Skidmore. But and I think in response to what Judge Pillard said, it seems that if there's an unfairness to this, there's a safety valve, which is the discretionary rule that says you can be exempted from all of these requirements. And it is puzzling to me why your client isn't a textbook case of somebody who should fall under that exemption. But I guess that's a question for the SEC.
Well,
but that there's that. And it just seems to me there's an argument that you did not make, which seems kind of important to me, which is that it seems to me that the SEC used the word voluntary in your sense in communicating with your client, where they said, your client should understand, you know, please come in for an interview. It will be voluntary. And also, if your client is amenable to a voluntary interview, it doesn't strike me as fair that the SEC can change the meaning of the word voluntary in its correspondence with your client, John Doe, and then say, no, we didn't mean voluntary for purposes of an award. So to me, these go more under the discretionary exemption issue, which to me is a stronger issue for you than the actual statutory interpretation issues.
Thank you. I just to clarify one point. It's the giving of the award that incentivizes others to come forward. And that came out in the SEC's own rulemaking when they discussed the size of awards, in which they originally said, well, why give them so much money? And it came out, no, giving large awards incentivizes others to come forward. Whistleblowers are coming forward, many of them not knowing about Dodd-Frank, not expecting an award, but it's the granting of the award that really generates the incentives. In regard to the...
But not by definition, not to people who don't know about...
No, by definition, to people who don't know about it. In this particular
case...
Because
they just think that it would all happen ex post. They might all just happen ex post.
No. In this particular case, granting this award would be the first award given to a whistleblower in this entire area of the economy, a massive area of the economy. Mark my word, people are looking at that. And the amici make that point. But I just want to go back to the original rulemaking. At the time the commission was evaluating the rule, they knew there could be inadvertent consequences to disclosures to third parties. They also had a policy statement that says, going to the press is, this is their words, an essential means of bringing securities law violations to light and ultimately helps deter conduct. Under Skidmore and under common sense, when that needed to be evaluated. But if you look at the entire hundreds of pages of rulemaking, never once was this policy statement referenced or the impact which the commission recognized. They also, at the time, knew that their enforcement staff was reading the newspapers. And again, this was not informed judgment, and it was not based on experience, because experience showed the value of the news media. So there it is. They're looking at the term voluntary. They're exempting people from that. In other words, there's two classes of voluntary. One, they follow Webster's. The other, they have this ironclad rule, you're out. Even in a case like this, where the disclosure was so significant, it commenced the investigation in days, you're out. So when they were making that gatekeeper, they didn't evaluate the existing experience and informed judgment of the commission in regard to news media disclosures.
So even if you're correct, that disclosing to media is a time-honored way for whistleblowers to blow the whistle, you're asking us to hold that that is the only way they're allowed to define voluntary here. Because for us to rule in your favor, we have to say it was arbitrary, capricious. You just can't have a regulation that doesn't include the media. And there are, as Judge Rogers pointed out, reasons why they included the other entities that they did. These are regulatory authorities. We're trying to encourage you to disclose to regulatory authorities, not necessarily the media. And even if you're right, why do they have to include the media?
They have to do it because it was Congress's judgment to include media disclosures into the definition of original information, which meant they had to, at the time they were doing the regulations, to consider that. Before they cut them out of that provision, they had to at least consider it. They had to do informed judgment. They had to base it on their experience. They didn't cite to their enforcement manual, the policy statement. They didn't cite to the definition of original information, although they were covering all of the other types of groups that were covered in that definition of third-party disclosures.
I think, though, we're back to my previous question, which you're saying if it's original, it has to be voluntary.
If it was to the news media, voluntary at the time you gave it to the news media, then it would carry over.
No, I understand that that's what you want
yes.
to happen, but your interpretation is if it fits the definition of original, the commission had no discretion to define voluntary any other way. Voluntary has to equal original.
And I would have two arguments that first, I totally agree with that statement. But second, if you're going to give any consideration to this regulation, it can't stand because they didn't think about that. There's nothing to show that one person in the SEC actually thought about the scenario we're facing today.
Well, but the argument could be that they didn't have to, because it was a given that there would be media disclosure. So the SEC was confronted with, well, what more are we going to do to address Congress's concern about incentivizing?
Well, it was, and you're right,
they're
think
moving on. They don't need to go back because they already know some disclosures will be made to the media.
And then it was incumbent upon them, once they realized that their regulation as proposed could have, in their own words, inadvertent consequences, it could mean someone who should be considered a legitimate whistleblower.
Well, that's the argument
isn't
about discretionary authorization.
If it's in the statute, if it's voluntary is defined in the entire Dodd-Frank in a manner consistent to what we argue, if it was in the IRS law, if it was in the False Claims Act, if the methodology of being voluntary was actually, our argument is consistent with every False Claims Act they actually cite to.
Well, the False Claims Act, I thought the definition of voluntary is you have to initiate to the regulatory entity.
No, because the False Claims Act explicitly says that if the regulatory entity learns it from the news media, the whistleblower still qualifies as original source. And then what occurred in all of the cases they cite to, they look at, was this whistleblower, who clearly would have been first to file, that's the only way they're even in court, were they voluntary as required under the statute? And in each case, they essentially apply the Webster Dictionary definition. They disqualify someone for being a government employee, for having a subpoena, for getting immunity, and exactly the type of procedure that should have occurred in this case. So it's remarkable that the commission's entire foundation for this regulation are False Claims Act cases. The leading one actually cites to Webster. They apply it in every case. So the exact argument you're saying about, well, if you go to the news media, are you qualified? The answer is no, because under the False Claims Act cases, they take the next look. They apply Webster, and they determine whether under Webster you're voluntary or not.
You're referring to the False Claims Act, but at least one of the cases that really explicitly, one of the False Claims Act cases that really explicitly talks about the meaning of voluntary is the Eighth Circuit's Barth case, and there the relator didn't say anything until approached by the government, and the case holds that waiting until the government contacts you isn't voluntary. So that seems quite consistent with the SEC's approach here.
No, because if you read the facts of the case, the actual story, the issue, was first reported in the news media. Consequently, under the False Claims Act, under Dodd-Frank, this Barth would have been automatically disqualified.
No, because if it's first in the news media, but you promptly, next day, same afternoon, before the SEC finds it in the news media, if you file, you're fine.
Yeah, but in this case, in the Barth case, the government investigation was initiated in part from the news media disclosure. In other words, the original information from the news media was not given by Barth. So they're out under original information. Then you hit to voluntary. And the key words they use here is not going to the government first, quote, played no part in exposing it, end quote. And they looked at the facts, which is exactly what Webster requires you to do. Webster does not have a mechanistic interpretation A to B. You look at the factual context. So here they had someone who played no role in exposing it. Okay, so the government comes to them after someone else exposed it. Our case is radically different. It's our guy exposed it.
So you're saying the voluntariness is just dicta in part?
I'm saying that they applied a reasonable interpretation of Webster. And they looked at...
when you say Webster, you're talking about the dictionary.
Webster's dictionary. Webster. Correct. And that's another way of even looking at this entire case, because the commission in the rulemaking looked at these four cases, all of which are consistent with Webster's dictionary. I just want to say that sitting back now, given the facts of this case, I mean, what would Webster have concluded? Additionally, think about your interpretation of voluntary in the context of Webster's.
So we've given you a lot of extra time.
I know.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, I do have one, which is, so you're pointing to this dictionary plain meaning understanding of voluntary. Can you identify in the administrative submission the place, the page number in the JA that you think most squarely raises that version of your voluntariness claim?
Yes, and just as the caveat, and I'll do that right now, is clearly Loper, with his emphasis on dictionary definition, switched it. But I'll go right now. JA 148, we said he was voluntary as a matter of law. And our position was the whole law, including voluntary. JA 163, the regulations are inherently defective. JA 158.
None of these are saying, ordinary meaning. When you say here, as a matter of law or operation of law, I took that much more directly to be the argument that you make more explicitly, which is the relationship between the list in the definition of original and the relationship, the truncation of that list when some of the same entities appear in the regulatory definition of voluntary.
But
so any language that talks about dictionaries or common understandings or the idea, sort of the ordinary meaning of voluntariness. You said 148. I mean, I have the cites from your brief.
Yeah.
I just wondered where you
think that the central cite was on 159, after discussing the regulation that if excluding the news media from that from the regulation was intentional, it would be a, quote, troubling violation of the DFA's plain language, end quote. Mm-hmm. I think to preserve an argument on appeal and the waiver test, if you look at Edelson v. OPM, we raised it in a form. We raised the issue. If you then look at intervening law, and Loper, without a doubt, shifts the analysis heavily to dictionary definitions. And then if you go to futile, which is a very clearly, under KPMG, a very clearly articulated agency position. So their definition of voluntary was opposed during the rulemaking. Their definition of voluntary was opposed to the commission in the Ross case, which we argued and we lost. Their definition of voluntary was opposed before this court. The commission vigorously
hadn't even been decided by at the point that you're responding here, had it?
I would have to go back and look at the dates, but it's clear that the commission's position on voluntary was well established.
The preservation doesn't depend on whether the commission would be close to it. You're making an argument that it's in conflict with the statute. However stubborn the commission wants to be, you have to preserve an argument that then you're going to vindicate in court. You know, you're expecting them to petition us and say, contrary to the statute, to revoluntary the way they did. So you need to put the argument for them, even if you think they're going to reject it. That's not futility. You would have an opportunity to bring it forward to the court.
In KPMG, it does say it can be futile if it's a very clearly articulated agency position. But moreover, we specifically stated violation of the plain language. And I think to preserve an argument on appeal, that was all we needed to do. We had 20 pages.
I think your far stronger argument is that the SEC erred in not granting you a discretionary exemption and explaining it, because the SEC has the power to conditionally or unconditionally exempt your client from this voluntariness requirement, which is tricky, as our discussion has revealed. And in explaining why they were not giving the exemption, all they said was that one of the principal objectives is to promote effective enforcement by providing incentives for persons with knowledge or misconduct to come forward. That's the reason for the rule. That's not a reason for why you would exempt somebody or not exempt somebody from the rule. And that seems to me plainly insufficient to explain why an exemption wasn't given here. That seems to me a much stronger argument to me than what you're arguing.
We raised those issues for the commission and before this court. I think if you look at the standard for Section 36A, in the public interest, there's just no doubt that what Doe did was in the public interest. In the interest of investors, absolutely no doubt he met that criteria. We pointed to their exemption cases where they exempted voluntary.
Yes.
And we pointed to their cases where they exempted TCR.
So this seems to me a much stronger argument to me. And if we were to remand because there was an error in applying the discretionary exemption requirement, what would be the scope of that remand? Could you raise your voluntariness arguments? Could you raise the other thing, which we're not sure are preserved? Like, what would be the scope of a remand typically? Maybe this is a question for the SEC, but in your experience.
If that was the sole reason for a remand, we would ask that the record be reopened based on a very simple factor, which was the news media did not really have an opportunity to address any of these issues, especially during the rulemaking. I think if you're weighing public interest, the interest of investors, it would be important. We could get information from some of those other constituents that could demonstrate that this was and the importance of this type of exemption. On the other hand, we did preserve, and you could just do a narrow remand.
But counsel, that answer suggests that your version of a remand is to reopen the entire case, and we, under Allied Signal, might simply remand to give the agency an opportunity to explain its reason. And I know your point about Loper-Bright, but if the agency gave a reasonable explanation as to why it declined to exercise its discretion, that would be sufficient without going back to square one, as you suggest. So, What is the strongest argument that we wouldn't apply our traditional scope of remand in this type of situation where the agency denies it? It says in a very simple conclusory sentence why, and we say that's not good enough. Tell us why. The distinction I'm trying to draw? We're not sending it back, say, for a new trial. We're just sending it back for a better explanation for your act. That would be the Allied Signal remand.
Your Honor, and there's no doubt such a narrow remand clearly within your authority and would not be improper at all.
The question, though, is why would we do more? Under what authority would we do more and say basically new trial?
Well, it would be only reopening the record as to the Rule 36A exemption.
No, but as I understood your response to Judge Pan, and maybe I misunderstood it, you were saying, yes, but that entitles us to go back, to introduce new evidence, to make new arguments, and to the extent that the court expressed some doubt as to whether we had raised certain arguments, we want to make it very clear that we are raising those arguments. That's what I mean by going back to square one.
Yes, so I did, then, I'm sorry, I would have misspoke. It would be limited to a discussion of 36A, period. We're not looking to reopen the rulemaking or reopen any of the substantive arguments. It would simply be going back to Rule 36A. I also think that's justifiable because the appeal of the case, the administrative appeal, was limited to 20 pages, double-spaced, in which we had to address a multiple number of issues, including demonstrating that he had original information. So the administrative appeal was limited by the regulation, and we were unable to do like a full-fledged briefing on 36A. We preserved, but I think on remand, I think it would be very helpful both to the commission and to the public interest to be able to address the 36A criteria more thoroughly.
Thank you.
And thank you for the extra time. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Emily Truparisi for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Petitioner Doe does not dispute in this appeal that under the commission's whistleblower rules, he did not submit his information voluntarily, which is a statutory requirement for an award. Instead, as has been discussed this morning, he raises two arguments against the commission's regulation itself, only one of which was raised to the commission below, or he argues instead that he should have been given an exemption from the rules. None of petitioner's arguments have merit, and the commission's order should be affirmed. I'd like to turn to the exemption piece that Judge Pan was asking about, unless the court would like me to start with the statutory argument or have any questions there.
I'm a little bit interested in,
sure.
I mean, if you look at, he's made an argument that the rule is in conflict with the statute, and it fairly encompassed in that is that the rule misinterprets the term voluntary. So is it not hair splitting to say that he's forfeited, he hasn't preserved an argument that a reason why it's error to write a rule that omits the press from the voluntariness definition while it's included in the list of entities to whom information can be communicated and remain original, that he's making that argument? And it seems a reason why he says that that's inconsistent with the statute is, voila, dictionary definitions. Like, why is that not a fairly included aspect of the argument that he did make in his submission to the commission?
Yes, Your Honor. A couple of points on that. I think it's not fairly included. I mean, certainly there was nothing about as the discussion suggested, there's nothing about dictionaries suggesting that he's making the argument that he's making now. The commission didn't address it because it didn't read it that way. And I think it's because the two arguments that counsel said is closely related, and I think your question's getting at, they're actually a little bit in tension because the second one presupposes the definition of voluntary. It doesn't suggest there's anything wrong with the word. It just says when you have voluntariness, then there's exceptions to it in A2. So it almost presupposes that voluntariness can mean the same thing.
Spell that out a little bit. I'm not sure.
Well, there's nothing about needing to be wanting the news media to be an exception that says there's anything wrong with how the commission has defined voluntarily vis-a-vis subpoenas and things. In fact, it just it says the definition is fine. We just want an exception. So it's a little hard to see how the commission was supposed to infer from an argument about saying the definition is fine, we just want the news media included as an exception, that the plain language of the word itself is somehow troubling, especially given that they don't raise it anywhere in their papers below.
Oh, I see. When you say exception, I'm not thinking of it so much as an exception, but that you voluntarily gave it to another entity and that is deemed to be as if you gave it voluntarily to the commission, but you're calling that the exception.
Yeah, if you look at how the rule is sort of written, it's like A1 is voluntary, A2 has the exceptions, which says even if you've gotten that request, inquiry, or demand, which is spelled out in A1, you can still be voluntary if you voluntarily provided it to those entities. So that's why that's sort of an exception to A1, which is the voluntariness definition.
Right. So you're saying that these are really two, in a way, factually different, because one focuses on the undisputed voluntariness of his provision of information to the media, and the other focuses on the voluntariness of his interactions ultimately with the SEC.
Yes, Your Honor. And so it's just, it's hard to see how the commission was supposed to divine that argument out of what was raised. And it was forfeited below.
So are we taking a magic words position here?
No, certainly I don't think there's a magic words position, Your Honor. They said plain meaning. There's no magic words, but it's certainly just there's nothing at all, if you read the entire 20-page submission, suggesting to the commission that they were saying there's something wrong with the way you've defined request, inquiry, or demand to mean voluntary. And there's just no way the commission was put on notice to respond to it, and that's why it didn't. There's no magic words, but it had to raise, as the cases say, it has to raise the substance of the argument. And as my colloquy with Judge Pillard suggested, that there's nothing in there that raises the substance of the argument.
I understand your colloquy as to the exception argument, but go back to the initial argument, the challenge to the rule as it defines voluntariness.
Right, Your Honor.
What is this case all about? Is sort of the argument.
Right, but
says his submission ought to be deemed eligible, and one of the reasons is because he did voluntarily come forward, and he cites all of these reasons why. So the commission being very alert to this, a big case, and in the rulemaking, had all of these different points of views before it. Had statutory examples it could have followed more directly, and it didn't. So he comes forward now and says, error. And the court no longer has to defer to the commission under his interpretation of local rights.
Right, Your Honor, but just to be clear, he did come to the commission and say, I was voluntary, but not for the reason he presents in his argument about anything about the definition of voluntary being absent of compulsion or something. He said, by giving it to the news media, I voluntarily gave it to the SEC, and the commission responded and rejected that, and he does not press that argument on appeal. Instead, he's made a very different argument, which is that the commission's definition of voluntary in 4A1, which is that if an investigative authority initiates before you come to it, that's no longer voluntary. He challenges that, and that is nowhere pressed below. And it wasn't futile to raise it. People have raised it in cases before.
Let me be clear, and I may just misunderstand something. I thought his argument number one was, whatever this rule covers, and whatever it exempts, I am eligible for an award because going to the media first was contemplated by Congress. These other statutes on which Dodd-Frank was modeled embrace that notion. And there's no rationale here that's offered for a different approach. And I understand your point where he doesn't use the magic words, but I want to understand why coming to the precipice of using those magic words isn't enough to put the agency on notice where he cited authority.
I still think it's because, Judge Rogers, he's making a different argument. And I think we lay this out on in our brief.
Yeah.
Because it's conflating two different things. He's saying I went to the news media. I get that. But even if you but his principal statutory argument, which he made for the first time to this court and presses on appeal, is different because even there, if you accepted his dictionary definition of voluntary, which means it's something close to you have to be compelled, if you went to the media and then the commission found out about it and subpoenaed you, you wouldn't be voluntary. So there's a mismatch between his arguments that it's just not fair to say that he raised the principal statutory argument below because of all these reasons. It's just a different argument.
You had said at the opening that you would talk about the exempting authority. And I think that Joe makes a good point in the reply brief that somebody who is very credible, has very damning evidence of egregious large-scale violations, and lands on the front page news worldwide and quickly catches the SEC's attention, is going to more readily, under the rule, be disqualified from eligibility than a less credible whistleblower who, in my example, you know, gives the story to some small regional newspaper that maybe the SEC will stumble upon 12 months later, 6 months later. Why is that not a pretty substantial argument for the exemption authority? And I guess relatedly, Judge Pan had suggested this previously, that as I read the reasoning for denying the exemption, it really just tracks the policy rationale behind the regulation. Is there anything else that you can point to where the nature of this case and the common sense voluntariness of the cooperation with the SEC was not deemed to be sufficient for an exemption?
Sure. A couple of points on the exemption. I mean, just a few threshold points. Obviously, you know, when we're talking exemptions, it's sort of at the highest level of deference to the commission. That's the Copley Fund case. This is when asking for an exemption from voluntariness, it's an exemption from a statutory requirement as opposed to a form and manner rule. And the commission has traditionally taken the approach that it's obviously going to scrutinize an exemption from a congressionally imposed requirement more carefully because...
Although this is from the commission's own rule.
Yes, but as we are, you know, and as we can get into, we think that's the best reading of Congress's intent. As in the record, there's only been, I believe there's three cases in the record where an exemption from voluntary has been granted. And that is because of the reasons the commission gave, which is that the purposes of the requirement are to incentivize whistleblowers to come to the commission. And as you see in the exegesis of the exemption at footnote 26 in the JA at 196, they say in these circumstances, giving an exemption would conflict with those policy rationales of the statute because the whistleblower did not come to the commission before the commission came to it.
For example, there are things that are in the brief, you know, saying that he didn't respond at first and that he said he wouldn't. And I wonder if there are things the public doesn't know that undergird this denial of the exemption that, you know, I do understand the general policy point, but is there nothing more case specific in somebody who paid to fly internationally, absolutely made himself available to the House committee, to the commission, and in fact was the source of the information, I gather, that started the investigation in the first place. So there's a lot of equities on Doe's side.
Sure, but again, it's an exemption to a statutory, you know, it's an exemption to the statutory requirement. And, you know, as the commission talks about in its final order, Doe did stop responding to the commission's requests. That's in the JA in final order. And Doe didn't submit the information to the commission in a TCR until many months after the, investigation ended. And so there are equities both ways, and it's certainly not an abuse of discretion at the highest level of discretion for the...
No, you're telling us that, but that's not what the commission told. And that's the issue I thought that Judge Pan was focusing on.
Well, everything I just said is in the final order of the commission. I don't know that the abuse of just, you know, arbitrary and capricious review, you have to tick and tie it.
Sorry,
to...
does it say that every exemption we've ever given before were to people who disclosed directly to the SEC before the media or anybody else?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was saying the facts I was talking about with Judge Pillard in terms of some of the equities.
Correct. And so what we're trying to figure out is whether the SEC erred in explaining why they were denying the exemption, because all they said was it's against the general policy. Like, you, why would there ever be an exemption if you're only going to follow the policy, right? And so your response to us here was that it doesn't, our policy is to reward people who disclose to the commission. And in these previous cases, that's what happened. Is it true that in every case you've granted an exemption, there was a direct disclosure to the SEC, not through the media, not through anybody else? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I'm trying to say in those other cases, there were other extenuating factors that are not at play in Doe's case here.
So what's the best response? I know this is not, this is separate from what the SEC did. I think that their explanation is clearly inadequate. But what is the best reasoning the SEC would have to deny a whistleblower request subject to the under the exemption in this case, where we have kind of a classic whistleblower who gave important information, spoke truth to power at great personal risk to himself, and did so, you know, to the public good? And that is, why isn't this exemption really aimed towards people like John Doe in this case? And what is the best rationale that you would provide for not giving an exemption to this whistleblower?
Well, as I think we set forth in our brief, the cases where we've given an exemption have involved either someone who has been, didn't know there was a subpoena directed at the employer and they were the employee, so they didn't even know about the investigation, or there was, in another case, they had been diligently trying to raise it internally and they came to the commission as soon as they realized that wasn't going to work. Here, there were none of those circumstances present. There was nothing preventing the whistleblower from coming to the commission and following the requirement.
But the impact of this disclosure seems so much greater than what you just explained.
I mean, that may be so here, but we can't be sure in every case. And the point is, there was nothing preventing.
So it's a case-by-case determination, correct?
Certainly the exemption is a case-by-case determination, Your Honor. And the commission.
And are there many disclosures with the kind of impact that this one had, like that the SEC has encountered? Isn't this somewhat extraordinary?
Large wards in the past, this is not out of character, but no one is trying to suggest that this wasn't a big investigation or a useful investigation. I think what the issue here is the exemption, and the commission explained, says granting an exemption under these circumstances, which encompasses everything in the order, doesn't fulfill the purposes of the statute as Congress laid them out, because there were no exceptional circumstances preventing this whistleblower to come to the commission. But certainly, if Your Honor thinks the reasoning in the order is insufficient, the commission could do a better job explaining it on a limited remand, as was discussed with my opposing friend. But I do think that given the sort of limited review of exemption determinations, what was put here was sufficient to justify the denial of the exemption here.
And the other thing that caught my eye, which I wanted to ask you about, is the commission's use of the word voluntary. In communications with John Doe, you use the word voluntary in the sense that he's advocating before us. You said your client would understand this interview is voluntary, meaning you're coming willingly. And if John Doe is amenable to a voluntary interview, we'd like to interview him. And why does the commission get to change the meaning of voluntary when it comes time to give an award?
Yes, Your Honor. I think as we explained.
And why isn't that a factor that should weigh in favor of a discretionary exemption?
Certainly that wasn't pressed below as a favor of an exemption. But I think more to the point, as we explained in our brief, I mean, the word voluntary, we agree, is susceptible to different interpretations. And it's very clear if you look at those enforcement emails in the record that it's being used. It's like it's submitting a certain form to Doe, and it's...
Oh, that's a form communication? So you're telling all whistleblowers that voluntary means come in willingly?
No, no, it's attaching a form that has to do with enforcement investigation, and it's very much distinguishing. It's very clear from the context of those communications. It's distinguishing between voluntary as opposed to you're about to be interviewed under subpoena. So it's using that different definition.
That's the meaning of voluntary that he's advocating.
In the context of an enforcement investigation, that's not the same meaning of voluntary that Congress used in the statute. We recognize.
Now you're splitting hairs because the SEC is using the word voluntary in two different ways with the same whistleblower.
I mean, the fact that commission enforcement staff was using it doesn't speak to what the commission meant when it said in its rulemaking and considered all these issues and then promulgated a definition of voluntary.
But from the point of view of a whistleblower, they're communicating with the SEC, and the SEC has called this voluntary. And then when he comes to ask for an award, you've completely changed the meaning of voluntary.
I mean, yes, although by this time he's already not voluntary. It's happened after the congressional investigation. So I'm not sure it matters here, but I take
voluntary in the other sense. I'm just saying that this seems to me another factor which weighs in favor of a discretionary exemption.
I mean, I think Your Honor, it points out that there are different meanings of voluntary.
So can I ask you something? What is the money at stake here? Would he get 10 to 30%? The money comes out of the actual award. Like where's the money come from?
Well, comes out of the investor protection fund, as spelled
which
out,
which is where the money obtained goes and would otherwise be given to compensate harmed investors.
No, it's not taken out of disgorgement awards. It's from monetary penalties. It's the amount is spelled out in the statute,
and that money otherwise goes to. It doesn't go to whistleblowers.
It's in a fund for whistleblowers.
And are these cases often settled? Like, do you ever settle with these whistleblowers? Because, you know, we don't want to give you 30% of $5 billion, but we'll settle this case with you for...
No, Your Honor, there's no mechanism for a compromise award.
So there are never settlements in these cases?
Not in, I think, the sense that Your Honor is talking about. No, it's based on the factors. The commission makes a finding as to the factors, and you either qualify or not. It's fairly binary. I mean, obviously, there's discretion amongst the award percentage, but there's no... there's usually not like a settlement mechanism.
And do you know whether there were other parallel agencies in other countries that investigated this, or there's no other source of any award for anything?
My friend on the other side might know more if there was a source of the award. I'm not aware. I mean, certainly there's information in the record that Doe was speaking with other investigative agencies, but whether an award was granted through those procedures, I do not know.
And in terms of a scope of a remand, what's your view of what would happen if we said you've made a mistake on this discretionary exemption decision and we remanded? What would the normal scope be?
I think it would be a limited scope to say the commission, if Your Honor thinks the commission's explanation of why it did not grant an exemption was insufficient, would be to a limited scope to have the commission explain it better.
But could we also hold not just that the explanation is insufficient, but your failure to grant was insufficiently explained, and therefore redo that whole decision?
I think it would be quite an extraordinary step for this court to order the commission to grant an exemption on these facts.
Oh, no, not order to grant, but reconsider the exemption, not just explain, not just leave the denial.
Sure, I mean,
but to redo the
right
decision-making process since there's no explanation.
I think we're saying the same thing, Your Honor, but yes, to reconsider the nature of the exemption and if it decides on remand again to explain it better.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Did Mr. Cohn reserve time for rebuttal? We'll give you 3.
I'll try to be short. I just, first off, in terms of the enforcement attorneys telling Doe that he was voluntary, it wasn't just the staff, it was their attorneys. But more important, they did hand him this form 1662. That was an official form, the SEC, which defined voluntary consistent with Webster's. So again, when you look at the rulemaking, 2010.
There's a definition on the form?
Yeah, it says you are rulemate, you are voluntary if there was no subpoena and it gives you your rights. So the attorney for the SEC said, you are voluntary, here's the official form.
Is that form in the record?
Yes.
In our JA?
It's on the JA, it's cited to public source. And so
the form was attached
to the email,
and it uses the word voluntary in the sense that you're advocating on appeal.
Correct. And what's significant about that is, again, it goes to the 2010-11 rulemaking, where the commission had already thought about voluntariness in terms of witnesses, and it was not discussed in the rulemaking. I also want to say that in this particular case, any definition of voluntary that excludes a person like Doe and the actions he took leading up to his disclosures is not the best reading of that term.
But we're interpreting this to apply to all whistleblowers. And just because this is kind of an extraordinary case, you know, the saying, bad facts make bad law, or whatever, good facts make bad law. I don't remember what it is. But we can't decide this case just based on what you've just said, because it doesn't apply to him.
Well, even taking it just to a whistleblower who does go to the media, whose information to the news media is sufficiently credible and well thought out, that it is the trigger of the investigation. And in the statute, if your information triggers an investigation, it's in the regulations also, you become a qualified whistleblower. It's within that context, highly credible to the media, sufficient to initiate the investigation. This is very rare, and it puts a tremendous obligation on the whistleblower, because they then have to prove these facts. They have to prove they were the source. They have to prove that it was their information that triggered it. And in that context, the best reading of voluntary would be that person's voluntary. It's not a question of whether it's reasonable. That is no longer the standard, or supportable. It's a question of best reading. And a whistleblower who hits those factors, which they concede, that is the best reading of voluntary. And one last point, I would just want to call the court's attention to that there are a number of regulations at issue, but one of them is 21F-4B5. And that's the commission's definition of original information, 4B5.
I think you're just repeating your prior argument.
Yeah, and that unites the two. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is submitted.